went to them north. That's what actually happened in 28.
And we were going through the various interpretations that one finds in the commentaries, discussing the weak points of those interpretations. And we have mentioned the first being a mental impression, perhaps created by narcotics, psychological identification, satanic impersonation, and we were down to the fourth explanation that one finds in the textbooks and the commentaries, and that is that we have here a deliberate deception. Now this interpretation is very old, going clear back, even before the time of Christ in Jewish tradition. The Septuagint version tells us that the witch was a ventriloquist, and that she was trying to, of course, make Saul think that he was talking to Samuel. The weak points of that position, the same, several of them the same as we had for some of the other positions. Number one, the Bible does not say the woman reported the words of Samuel, but gives the impression that Saul talked directly to Samuel. Furthermore, it would seem to me to be highly unlikely, just given the sheer odds of the situation, that she would be able to guess that Saul and his sons would be killed in the battle the next day. How could she know that? I guess it's possible to guess such a thing, but it seems like to me the probabilities would be against that type of a guess. And furthermore, false prophets, if she was in fact trying to deceive Saul, she would be a false prophet, would she not? And false prophets normally try to flatter the king, not to predict his doom. I don't think you'll ever find a case of a false prophet who's predicting the doom of a king. They normally try to flatter the king, give him false optimism. So, for my money at least, I would have to scratch interpretation number four. I find the first four interpretations all weak in various ways. I come to what I think is the correct interpretation of the passage, and that is that Samuel actually reappeared from the dead. Now, verse 14 says that Saul perceived or knew that it was Samuel. That does not tell us that Saul actually saw Samuel, but it certainly comes very close to it. The word know is used some 773, this word yada is used some 773 times in the Old Testament, of which probably 678 times it is translated to know, and it has the implication of know intimately. Saul knew some way that this was Samuel. Some people say, well, Saul was bowed down to the ground. How could he see? Well, sure, he didn't stay in that prostrate condition the entire time. I don't think that would be a justifiable conclusion. What about the phrase, why the phrase in verse 15, Samuel says, why have you disturbed me, disquieted me? That to me at least suggests that the abode of the dead, for righteous people at least, was an abode of rest and peace and beauty. And once a person has left the scenes of this world with its tumult and trial and war and bloodshed and violence, I think that he does not care to reappear in this world. I think he's perfectly content in the world beyond. Saul had the responsibility of this incident by coming to the witch and by requesting that Samuel appear. I had a student one time ask me a question that threw me for a loop on this passage for a few moments till I had a chance to reflect on it a little bit. The student said, well, now Samuel is reappearing from the spirit world, right? I said, right. He said, but it speaks about him being clothed. Does that mean that people in the spirit world wear clothes? Now, the very simple answer to that question that really knocked me for a loop when I first heard it. Who knows the answer to that? Yeah. Or angels. Angels are seen. Right. Yes, every time angels appear all through the Old and the New Testament, there's no indication that they appeared without clothes on. They were visible and apparently were, well, in fact, it speaks of their garments, doesn't it? referencing the text, the witch really had much to do with it. I think God brought Samuel back. God brought Samuel back to pronounce the final doom upon Saul. And also, God brought Samuel back, I think, to put the fear of the Lord in that witch who's been playing around with the occult all these years. Now, that the spirit of Samuel himself actually returned is the view of the ancient Jewish people going clear back even before the time of Christ. One can find texts that support this position. That doesn't make it true. It just means it's an old interpretation. Most of the Jewish commentators hold to this view. Most of the early church fathers hold to this view. And unquestionably, it appears to be the most obvious interpretation of the passage. Verse 15, Samuel said to Saul. Verse 16, then said Samuel. Verse 20, the words of Samuel. And so it seems to me that Samuel did reappear. Now, some religious groups, like your Seventh-day Adventists, are very strong against this being an actual reappearance of Samuel. Does anyone know why? Seventh-day Adventists, the Herbert Armstrong Heights, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and all the others are quite determined that this is not an actual appearance of Samuel. Now, why would they be so adamant about this fact? Because of their view of the afterlife. Some of these groups teach that when you die, you're dead like a hog all over the log until the day of resurrection. So they're very determined that there is no afterlife or a place for departed spirits. And so this passage gives them a lot of trouble with that doctrine. And therefore they have to get around this passage by suggesting some other interpretation of it. Well, okay, what does Samuel actually say to Saul? We haven't really looked at that. He says four things. I would like to call these four blows against Saul. Verse 16, he speaks in the past tense of Saul's spiritual death. God has departed from you and become your adversary. That's spiritual death. Verse 17, he speaks of Saul's political death. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. That's his political death. Verse 19, his military death or defeat. The Philistines, you will fall into the hand of the Philistines tomorrow. And then, of course, also in verse 19, his physical death as well. You and your sons will be with me. Now, Samuel would obviously be in paradise. And when Samuel says with me, that does not imply that Saul will be in paradise. Paradise is simply part of Sheol. If we were to draw a diagram, Hades and Sheol, I think probably in your Acts class you had some lessons about Hades, have you not? Huh? You haven't talked about Hades? Life of Christ talks about Hades. Well, the New Testament Hades is the same concept as the Old Testament Sheol. And Sheol involves both a place of rest for believers and apparently a place of punishment, or at least a place that is less advantageous for those who were not righteous, same as Hades. And the Old Testament hints about these matters. The New Testament makes it clear in Luke 16 and other places as to the nature of this abode of the dead. So when Samuel says, tomorrow you will be with me, he does not mean in paradise. I don't know whether Saul went to paradise or not. Only the Lord knows that. I suspect he didn't, but I don't know. I don't want to pass judgment upon him. But I certainly don't think we have to conclude from the words of Samuel that necessarily Saul was saved when he died. It may have been. Only the Lord knows. But I don't think Samuel's words necessitate that. All right. That's about all I want to say about the witch episode. We have to go back and pick up one other detail that happened on that day. Well, poor Saul was killed in the battle, as you know. Tell me about how he died, and then we'll pick up what happened to David. How did Saul die? Describe it. He was wounded by an arrow, and he wanted his armor bearer to run him through lest he be said that he died at the hands of the Philistines, and the honor bearer refused, so how did he die? He fell on his own sword. Now, the details about the death of Jonathan, we do not know. Somebody asked the other day before class, well, why did the Lord let Jonathan die? Why did the Lord slay Jonathan? Well, now remember, this war that we're looking at here was a defensive war. The Philistines were invading their land. The Israelites were defending their land. If there is such a thing as a just war, I guess this would be it. You're defending your homeland, your wives, your children from a foreign invader. Jonathan is a member of the army. He's doing his duty. There's no indication that he's dying under the judgment of God. But when people go into war, people sometimes get killed. And the fact that God announces beforehand that Saul and his sons will be slain in battle does not necessarily imply that the sons have committed some terrible, wicked deed, especially Jonathan. I'd like to think that he had anyway. All right. And what about the, what did the Philistines do when they came upon the body of Saul? All right, the battle took place here apparently in the slopes of Gilboa. I say the slopes because the 2 Samuel mentions the chariots pressing down upon Saul. If Saul had been up in the heights of Gilboa, I don't think they would have been able to get their chariots up there. At any rate, they killed him. He killed himself, and they came upon his body. They took the bodies of Saul and his sons and tacked them up to the wall over here of a nearby city, Bethshean. Who took down the bodies off the wall? Men of Jabesh Gilead. Why would they have a special affection for Saul? Anybody recall the story? Yes, Mr. Martin. Saul's first military effort was to rescue the men of Jabesh Gilead down here from the Ammonites. And so they take the bodies down. What they do with the bodies? Well, they cremated them so that the Philistines would never be able to locate them. And what happened to Saul's head? What did they do with Saul's head? Didn't the Philistines carry his head around down in their kind of territory? And what did they do with Saul's armor? Put it in the temple of their gods down there. This was viewed as a great victory for the Philistine gods, you see, by the Philistines. Now, a fellow showed up at David's camp claiming, well, first we better get what happened to David. Now, David, you recall, had been dismissed from the battle. Now, this transparency is terribly dirty. This is just a dirty shame what happened to David on this transparency. But David, you recall, had been dismissed from the battle and had come back to his city down here in the southern part of Judah, Ziklag. When he got back, he found out the city had been ransacked, burned, and the inhabitants, including his wives, had been taken captive. He and his men immediately took off in pursuit. And 200 of his men were so tired when they got to this creek here that he left them there to guard the baggage. And he and the rest of his men pursued on. They found an Egyptian that had been almost killed out here in the wilderness. He knew where the Amalekites were. David and his men came upon them and destroyed them. 400 of them got away, but was able to effect the rescue of those who had been taken hostage. And then, what did David do with some of the loot that he gained from the Amalekites? Yes, he gave it to the elders of Judah. What's his purpose there, do you think? Make friends. He realizes that the end of Saul is not very far away, and he realizes that if he is ever going to be king, it will be with the support of the elders of Judah. And so he's trying to lay the groundwork for his future reign. What's that? Yes, that's true. They had taken a lot of the goods from Judah. That's a good point too, Mr. Presley. One other thing that came out of this was, remember there was a little bit of a dispute after this rescue as to who got the spoils. And David lays down a fundamental principle here that I think is very worthwhile. And what was the principle that David enunciated at this time? Okay, Mr. G.
Even though those doers, I just feel like they got their share.
Why?
Because, sir.
All right. Because, in other words, the quartermaster corps is to receive the same not appreciate that, really. My response to that is, don't be too hard on those men. After all, David hadn't set a very good example for them in the last few months, has he? How long was David in the land of the Philistines?
16 months,
that's correct. Okay, so the news then comes to David eventually that Saul has been killed and an Amalekite comes. And he brings evidence. What does he bring in his hand as evidence that he has slain Saul? Yes, he claims to have slain Saul. We know he was lying. But he brings the crown and some bracelets and whatnot to prove that he had killed the king. And rather than being rewarded, he thought he was going to be rewarded. Rather than being rewarded, David said, "You've laid your hand on God's anointed." And David ordered this Amalekite to cut down because he had claimed that he murdered King Saul. Well, he was God's anointed in the sense that he had been anointed way back at the beginning of his reign. And David's position in all of this was that he's not going to lay a hand on Saul. Saul had been anointed by a prophet of God. He was God's anointed. Now we know, reading the story, we know what has happened, that God has left Saul. But as far as David was concerned, God will take care of him. That's a pretty good philosophy. Just let the Lord handle it. And God took care of the whole situation. In his own way. David rent his clothes, mourned, wept, fasted over the death of Saul, and particularly over the death of Jonathan, his friend, and he wrote a poem. I want you to know the name of this poem. It's called The Song of the Bow. It's found in the first chapter of 2 Samuel, and it also was recorded in the book of Jasher. Now this is the second and last time we find a scriptural reference to the book of Jasher. Who recalls the first reference to the book of Jasher? The connection that it was something else we studied was written in the book of Jasher. Bryce? All right. The Joshua chapter 10 passage. And now here is another reference. This poem also was written in the book of Jasher, the book of the upright. So here we see David in the role of a poet. And one of the poems that he wrote was in commemoration of the death of Jonathan and Saul. Now you can tell we're halfway through the course because I'm changing notebooks. Okay, so then after the death of Saul, David goes up to Hebron, right in the heart of the territory of Judah, and there he is anointed king of the tribe of Judah. He'd already laid the groundwork for this, as we have seen. How long was he king over Judah by itself? Kelly? Julie? 7.5 years he was king over Judah by itself. And then David sends word to the men of Jabesh-Gilead. And what basically does he say in this note that he fired off to the men of Jabesh-Gilead? John, do you recall from your reading? Julie? Mr. Mark? All right. He commends them. See, everybody thought that David would be bouncing up and down in glee because Saul was dead. But everything he does is really contrary to probably the way most of us would have acted under the same circumstances. I mean, if you've been chased all over the country and eventually run out of the country by Saul, a guy's tried to kill you personally a couple of times and sent his army after you on 3 occasions, and he's finally killed in battle, wouldn't you say, let's have a feast and celebrate, it's all over. But that was what people expected from David, but that's not what they got. He shows appreciation to the supporters of Saul. And again, you might say, well, that's just good politics. Maybe it was. Maybe that's all it was. I'd like to think that it came from a sincere, genuine heart. No way to know, of course. In any case, David is trying to get on the good side of those who were Saul's diehard supporters. And I'm sure that this note written to the men of Jabesh-Gilead was received with great favor there. Now we enter into a period where we have what we might call the Civil War. David has now been made king of Judah. And the northern tribes are under the control, eventually at least, of
what man?
Well, okay, somebody says Abner, really, and I think you're probably right, but who at least wore the title? Ish-bosheth. Now, that was not his real name. His real name is given in Chronicles. His real name was Ish, which means man. You now know a Hebrew word. Ish means man. Ish-baal. Now, the writer of Samuel could not bring himself to admit that a son of Saul had the name Ish-baal, so he changed it to Ish-bosheth, which means man of shame. Man of shame. Shameful thing that he had the name Baal in his own personal name. Now, I don't know any other way to explain the fact that the same fellow's name is given in Chronicles as Ish-baal and in Samuel as Ish-bosheth. But it's the same fellow. That would make a great matching question, wouldn't it? Ish-bosheth and Ish-baal. Same fellow. Two names for one guy. All right. Now, how long did Ish-baal or Ish-bosheth rule over these northern tribes? How long? 2 years. That's correct. And yet David ruled down here for 7.5 years. Well, that means that the northern tribes were without a king for something like 5 or so years. Right? Now, what I think happened was this. I think that these northern tribes had had it with a king by this time. And when Saul died, they were very reluctant to go on with the monarchy. They didn't want to recognize David, and they didn't want to recognize Saul's son Ish-bosheth. I think for about 5 years, they just didn't have a king. And I think it was probably Abner that persuaded these northern tribes to back the claims of Ish-bosheth. Now, he moved his headquarters over here across the river. Apparently, Saul had more support over here on the eastern side of the river than he did on the western side. In any case, that's where Ish-bosheth's headquarters was. And so for 5 years, I think, Abner was working on trying to secure support for Ish-bosheth. And finally, then, he secured that support. Ish-bosheth was 40 years old at the time he became king. How old was David? 30. Was he 30? No. He was how old? No, he was 30 when he became king of all the tribes. He's 22 and 22, 21 and a half or 22, somewhere in that neighborhood at the time that he's anointed. Saul's son is 40. Okay, so let's do a little speculation. I think that's part of the responsibility of historians, whether we're talking about biblical history or secular history, to try to understand what happened, why. Why do you think Abner supported Ish-bosheth? Why didn't Abner recognize David immediately after the death of Saul? What were some of the dynamics in there? Dan? You think that he feared David? Okay, maybe. Mr. Preston? Okay, all right. Now, usually what happens at this point in reference to Abner, that the class will take two different approaches. Some will take the hard approach, which Mr. Presley has now identified, and see everything Abner does in a very villainous type of way, and others, I think, will probably come out with a rather positive view of Abner. It's hard to know, not being there on the scene, to observe carefully, and I think it is legitimate to take both views. You're thinking Abner wants to seize power, and he's doing it through this weak son of Saul. I'm thinking of a couple of other factors that would perhaps be a little more positive, Mr. J. Probably so. David has made a monkey out of him, hasn't he, for a number of months. But there's something even more recent than that that I think would have caused Abner a great deal of concern if he was a loyal, patriotic type person. Yes.
David had sided with
David had been in the actual army. he and his men of a Philistine king for a year and 4 months. True, he had not fought against Israel, but nonetheless, his loyalties were suspect. His loyalties were suspect. And another point is that Abner was related to Saul, either his cousin or his uncle, as we've already explored, and was intensely loyal to the house of Saul. And of course, normally in Bible days, a son succeeded his father's king. So there are a lot of factors that may have entered into Abner's decision not to back David immediately. When Abner gained enough strength, he and his men crossed the Jordan River and came down, apparently intending to attack David. And the two armies met at the Gibeon, right here in Gibeon, near a pool of water. And here are the two armies apparently approaching this pool, probably just to secure water for each other. And here we're on the eve of a rather important civil war. Before they fight, though, they decided to take the champions from both sides and put them out there and let them fight it out. And, of course, in theory, that was supposed to settle the issue, but unfortunately, in history, that type of solution never has worked out, really. That's what Goliath was trying to do, you know, have a one-on-one trial by combat type thing. So the two armies sent out their 12 best fighters on both sides, and they fought, and both armies were cheering on their men until what happened? They were all such skilled fighters, they all died on both sides. That must have been some battle to watch. I don't know how anybody could gain any glee out of watching 24 men kill themselves. But that's what happened, and it didn't solve the problem because the battle broke out anyway. And in the battle, in the course of the battle, Abner's men were experiencing the worst part of it. And Abner was fleeing from the scene of the battle. And here was a young soldier in David's army by the name of Asahel, whose famous brother Joab was the commander of David's army. Now I can just imagine this young man Asahel thinking that he would try to gain honor for himself, fame, if he killed the famous general Abner. That he would make a reputation and a name for himself forevermore. And so he's chasing Abner, perhaps up this hilly terrain, and Abner knows who he is and says to this young kid, he says, turn, get away, go right or go left, find somebody your own age and fight with them. You're taking on more than you're bargaining for here. And Asahel just kept coming. And finally, Abner smote him with his spear, with the butt of his spear, actually, and hit him so hard. Well, you read it. How hard to hit him. Right, you with the butt of his spear. Now, you'd have to hit a guy pretty hard, wouldn't you? Say, the butt of his spear clear through him. Yes. Well, apparently, he was trying. He was trying, just Abner was. You know, he waited till he got that close or waited till he caught up with him. Now, I don't know. The Bible doesn't describe it in detail. What I picture here is Abner has his sword and he's running with his back to Asahel. And perhaps he's kind of looking over his shoulder and Asahel perhaps ready to smite him and he takes his spear to back this way. Now, that may not have been the way it happened. That's the way I pictured it in my mind. But in any case, I think this text has real potential as a youth sermon because I see a lot of young people making the same mistake as Asahel. The Bible says something about his physical ability. What does it say about him? He was swift of foot. And this young man just thought he was so fast, he was so quick that this old man Abner didn't have a chance. And he pursued him until he finally pursued him to the point of his own death. And so here we have young people today that start after some Abner of the world and think that they, because of their youth and their swiftness and their smartness, can outsmart him. And they go after dope, for example. I don't think there's any young person that ever popped the first pill that thought that he would become an addict. I don't think anybody really sets out to become an addict. But they all have the attitude, I can handle it. Maybe other people. I can handle it. I'm strong. I'm, you know, I can take care of myself. And people say, turn aside. That's dangerous. You're flirting with death. You're going to destroy yourself. On they come, determined that they're going to conquer the adversary. Oftentimes, it means they're on doing the same drink, for example, and other things we can think of. So I think this text has some potential. Asahel did not realize the danger that confronted him. A lot of young people don't. Asahel had delusions in his own mind about his abilities to cope with Abner, and he was wrong. He was determined to pursue Abner even to the point of death. Of course, he finally tasted of that day. Now, this account is important because it sets the stage for several other murders down the road, or at least one other murder that we're going to come to even in today's lesson. All right, so Abner skillfully maneuvered his men onto one of the slopes or hills there, even though they had been essentially defeated. He got them together in such force on the top of the hill that Joab realized that to attack with the men that he had would be a terrible slaughter. Joab delayed. Sundown came. Abner and his men slipped away back across the Jordan to safety. Now, the battle casualties were rather one-sided. What was it? 314, I believe it was. 360. 360 men of Abner died and 19 men of David. Casualties were tremendously lopsided. Now, chapter 3, verse 1 of 2 Samuel tells us, it kind of summarizes this whole period. It says, now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. We've just looked at one skirmish. But apparently this was just one of many skirmishes. And David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. So that's just kind of a summary now of what's going on during this period. Now, there's trouble in the camp of Ish-bosheth. Ish-bosheth makes an accusation against Abner. What did he accuse him of, Mr. Lyon? All right. Now, to sleep with a wife, ex-wife of a king, or marry her, was, in the ancient world, tantamount to a claim to the throne. Ish-bosheth says, you are sleeping with my father's concubine. You're trying to become king. And if Ish-bosheth's accusation is true, then of course we have support from Mr. Presley's theory. We'll call this the Pressonian theory about Abner. On the other hand, can we be sure that Ish-bosheth was really telling the truth? Or are we looking at a man who was terribly jealous and terribly worried about his own position? And perhaps Abner had enemies in the court who were out to cut him down to size. I can't be sure in my own mind that the accusation was true. Abner certainly denied it, and doesn't he? And certainly acts very upset that anyone would think that he would be trying such a thing after all these years of service to the house of Saul. And in any case, Abner decides he's going to cast his lot with David, and David lays down one condition. What is it? Send back my wife, Michal. Again, notice David's anxious to have it known that he is married to the daughter of the former king. Very important. Well, he was already married to her anyway, but the marriage was had been dissolved, you recall, earlier when Saul had taken Michal and given her to someone else. So Ish-bosheth realizes that it's all over now, and he sends for Michal and sends her back to David. And it's a very sad verse in the scripture, verse 16 of chapter 3. But her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her as far as Bahurim. And Abner said to him, go, return. So he returned. Now, that's a kind of pitiful scene, isn't it? Apparently, this second husband loved her. I ended up giving the impression he was anxious to get rid of her. And follows her, had no control over the situation until Abner says, he's sitting there sharpening his sword, and he says, oh boy, you better go home. That's the end of the road for you. And so Michal comes back to David. I wonder how she felt. did she love this second husband? Or did she still love David? She loved him once, the Bible says. Did she still love him? I don't know. From this point on, Michal seems to be very negative toward David. This will come out a little bit later. I don't know what her feelings were in this whole matter.
How come verse 15 says Ishbosheth, you know, Ishbaal there, how come it says that he took Michal?
Well, I think he realized that Abner was, you know, that Abner's not going to support him anymore, and he had no hope of resistance, so he might as well try to, best he can, make peace with David.
I think that's the way I would look at it anyway. Well, you're happy.
Yes, he's waiting in his boots over Abner, didn't he? Now, Abner begins to appeal to the rest of the tribes. Then he says, you wanted David to be your king of the past. You didn't want Saul. Some of you, and so now's the time to acknowledge David as king. Meanwhile, Abner and David meet at Hebron to discuss their differences and to work out the formal agreement. Abner and 20 of his men come to this conference. It so happens that Joab is out of town. I wonder if David arranged it for that day on purpose. I don't think David ever did trust Joab. Abner comes in. They work out the details. And just about the time Abner's heading out of town, Joab comes in from some military exercises and finds out that Abner's been allowed to escape, and he just blows his gasket. He sends word for Abner. He says, David wants has something more to say to you, and gets him there at the city gate privately, says, I have something private I want to tell you, and smote him under the fifth rib. Mark down one murder for Joab. He commits three before it's all over. Now, what is this? Blood revenge? His brother was slain by Abner in battle, and now he's taking blood revenge in a time of peace. This is viewed by David and by others, by the sacred writers, as nothing but cold-blooded murder. David disassociates himself with what has happened, going into an elaborate mourning over Abner. And verse 38 of chapter 3 tells us, then the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? Now that was David's assessment. I don't know how that fits with the Pressonian theory. But that was David's, I think, his genuine feeling about Abner. A prince and a great man. And that makes it hard for me to believe, even though sometimes great men can make mistakes. It's hard for me to believe that Abner had any ambitions for himself, or that the accusations made against him were actually true. I realize the other interpretation is possible. You're free to accept whatever you wish to accept. Well, okay. Chapter 4 tells us how Ishbosheth lost out, met his doom. How was it? Two of his officers plotted against him. Now, there's something here very important that you need to note that perhaps you didn't realize. What city were these two officers, Baana and Rechab, what city were they from? Beeroth. I believe if you go back and check out Joshua, you'll find that Beeroth was one of those Gibeonite cities. Remember back there when the Gibeonites deceived Joshua? And Joshua gave an oath that the Gibeonites would never be slain. Now we're going to learn, if not today, I'm sure not today, we're not going to get that far, but tomorrow we'll learn that Saul had attempted to wipe out the Gibeonites. So perhaps these two officers had it in for the house of Saul. That might explain one reason why they turned on their king, beheaded him while he was asleep, and carried his head to David. Again, they undoubtedly thought they would be rewarded. David's enemy has now been killed. What was David's reaction? These men were killed, and their bodies were hung up, and a rather unusual thing was done to the corpse. Hands and feet were cut off. Why? That must have been the way that traitors were executed. It must have been a sign that these men had committed treason. They committed treason against their king, against their commander, Ish-bosheth. And David simply would have no part of any such thing. The treaties had already been worked out between David and Ish-bosheth. There was no need to kill him. Why didn't David kill Joab for murdering Abner? He tells you. He tells you. Look at verse 39 of chapter 3. Am I weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the son of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me? I think the answer was Joab and his brother Abishai just simply had too much power among the army. But David, if you read back in the text, made it very clear. He puts a curse in verse 29 on Joab's family. And before David died, Joab now is up in years and not as powerful as he once had been. David, before he died, he told his son Solomon, make sure that Joab gets punished for his crime. I've always thought that was a little bit cowardly that David would put the task on his son that he didn't have the guts to do. But nonetheless, he did. So David had a sense of justice that murderers should be executed. And the execution of Joab was delayed, but eventually he was executed for the murders that he had committed. Yes?
So Abner's covenant...
Still 5 minutes, folks. 5 minute warning bell.
His covenant with David was for all of Israel, then.
Well,
didn't even consult the king, whom their king.
Who, David?
No, Israel. I mean, wasn't Ishbaal still the king?
Well, I think once Abner bailed out, he was the one to return David's wife, and that indicates that he's on the verge of patching things up with David himself. Otherwise, he wouldn't have returned his wife, would he? So it looks to me like that he just realized that his ploy was over. He may not have even wanted to be king. It may have been the kind of fellow that didn't like power and didn't relish power, and Abner persuaded him, hey, you're the descendant of Saul, you've got to carry on, you know, in the old family tradition. I don't even know that Ish-bosheth really wanted to be king. So he apparently, we're in a transition period here where they're trying to get things smoothed out between the tribes. All right, now David then was anointed king over all of Israel. According to the record here, he had a covenant with the elders of Israel. He was anointed in Hebron. I want you to be able to list for me on our next test the three times David was anointed. Anointed by Samuel at Bethlehem, originally. Anointed king of Judah at Hebron by the elders of Judah. Anointed king of all Israel at Hebron by the elders of the northern tribe. So now 7.5 years we've covered today in our class. They celebrated this great occasion with a 3-day feast. And again, Chronicles supplies information that Samuel does not supply. Chronicles tells us that in a show of support for David, some 337,000 men came to Hebron as our army men, soldiers, to show their support for David. So this was some festival they had down there at Hebron. Now, one of the first things that David had to do was to find a suitable capital. Hebron was in Judah. That wasn't going to work. And this may have been part of the negotiations between the elders and David. So David selected a city which was a prominent city, but was still under the control of the Jebusites. It bordered on Judah and also on Benjamin, so it was an ideal city. It had walls 27 feet thick. But the city had one weakness, and that was in its water supply. And so David challenged his men to go up and to capture the city of Jerusalem. The men of the city of Jerusalem laughed at him. They said, why? Even if every one of us was blind and lame, you wouldn't be able to capture our city. You can't come through our walls. But David had other plans in mind. Now, don't misunderstand what David is saying here. A lot of students have misunderstood verse 8. David said on that day, whoever Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul through the water tunnel. Now, some people have read that and said, oh, isn't this terrible? David is attacking lame and blind people. But understand what's going on here. The people of Jerusalem have referred to themselves in these terms. When they said, you know, even if we were lame and blind, you wouldn't be able to conquer us. So David said, go up there and show those lame and blind people a thing or two. So they went through the water tunnel. You can still walk through this water tunnel today. I hope you get to on your Holy Land trip. My group did when we were over there. You walk back through here. It goes much further back now than this because King Hezekiah picked it up here and carried it on back into the city. But in David's day, it went back like this. And they found this tunnel, and here there was a shaft. What they would do is, in time of war, they would walk down this incline, down these steps, down this slope. They would let buckets down to pick up water. They dammed up this spring, forcing water back through this tunnel into a reservoir here. So they could let down buckets and pick up water, bring it up into the city, and they thought they were perfectly safe because this was hidden out here on the outside of the slope of the city. Somehow David knew about it, or Joab knew about it. Well, I guess David did too. And Joab and some of his men went into this water tunnel, shinned up this wall, which is sheer wet rock. And how they did it, I don't know. I looked at that when I was in that tunnel, and I couldn't. It looked like I wouldn't want to try it, I'll tell you that. Some of you spider men may try, but not me. And then on up through here, now this part that's in dotted lines, today you can't go up there. It's not this much of it has been excavated, but of course buildings and so forth are on top. Anyway, they came inside the city, surprised the inhabitants. No doubt they flung open the gates.